This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 7th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, part two of my interview with Dick Pound, the Canadian who is the most senior member of the International Olympic Committee, plus the latest on the SNC-Lavalin scandal. And the Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are British Columbians suffering from a lack of a true opposition party in the BC legislature? Christy Clark and the BC Liberals left BC Hydro, ICBC, and BC Lottery Corporation in such a shambles in so many different ways that switching leaders to Andrew Wilkinson did nothing to return credibility to the Free Enterprise Coalition. Socreds used to rule BC, now the Nocreds are in opposition. Which is a big problem, because John Horgan and the NDP government are starting to need a very big dose of opposition. Yes, Andrew Weaver, Adam Olson, and Sonia Firstenau of the Green Party are acting as a check on the NDP's power, but there are only three of them in the third-party caucus, and they have also agreed to support NDP budgets and throne speeches, so their opposition only goes so far. The reason an opposition is needed now is that the NDP announced changes to the Information Management Act on April 1st, hoping to fool British Columbians into believing that there is now a duty to document law. Well, there isn't. All the NDP did was add 41 agencies to a law that was passed by the BC Liberals. This was the NDP that tabled a strong duty to document bill that died on the order paper in 2016, and they promised in the 2017 election campaign to replace the ineffective BC Liberal law with a real duty to document law with fines of up to $50,000 for the willful destruction of public records. Instead of fines, they're now going soft. The focus is on, quote, training, staff support, and assigning experts to provide guidance and to perform reviews, end quote. I wanted to interview Ginny Sims, the minister responsible, to ask her one simple question. Why did you break a promise from your 2017 election platform? Sims, I was told, was unavailable to speak with me, so she wasn't going to answer my question. The BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association called the NDP statement a significant misrepresentation and a sad excuse for what is needed to be done. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Japan Times, Kyoto reports Carlos Ghosn suspected of redirecting Nissan money to himself via Oman. Less than a month after being released on bail, Ghosn was arrested again April 4th over a fresh allegation of aggravated breach of trust, this time in connection with the misuse of funds paid to the distributor. He denied all of the allegations. The ousted boss of Nissan and Renault, whose case has gripped Japan and the rest of the business world, said in the interview that if he knew his trial would turn out fair, he would not be worried. The Omani company received a total of $31 million from 2012 as sales incentives paid out of Nissan's CEO reserve, a pool of funds Ghosn could use at his discretion, the sources said. A large amount of money was then transferred from the personal account of an executive in charge of accounting at the Omani company to Good Faith Investments, a Lebanese investment firm effectively owned by Ghosn. In the Anchorage Daily News, Michelle Theriault-Boots reports, after a recent burst of violence, Anchorage is on pace to exceed homicide record. Beyond the 10 homicides in 2019, police have classified two other deaths as suspicious, but haven't officially determined whether they are homicides. The spasm of violence puts Anchorage on pace to surpass a grim record set in 2017, when 35 people died in homicides in Alaska's biggest city. And in the South China Morning Post, Lee Jong-ho reports, Chinese governor gives South Korean politician a surprise gift that turns out to be a portrait of his fiercest rival. Guangdong Governor Ma Ching-ri, who was leading a delegation visiting the South Korean capital, met the city's mayor, Park Won-soon, on April 5th. But when the mayor unwrapped it, he found it was a portrait of his biggest political rival, Lee Jae-myung, governor of the neighboring Gyeonggi province. who also plans to seek the presidential candidacy. City officials said their Chinese counterparts had explained that the artist commissioned to produce the papercraft portrait had been given a photograph of the wrong politician. Once it was finished, officials wrapped up the picture and took it to Seoul without checking. Well, it's the thought that counts. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. From humble beginnings as a child swimmer in Ocean Falls, British Columbia, to a member of Team Canada at the Rome 1960 Olympics, Dick Pound became one of the leaders in world sport as a vice president of the International Olympic Committee. The outspoken Montreal lawyer, who recently turned 77, founded the World Anti-Doping Agency. He is the most senior member of the IOC. Pound was in Vancouver for the Canadian Club Vancouver lunch on April 1st. I sat down with him on March 28th. Listen to his thoughts on the state of world sport in Part 1 last week. In Part 2 this week, I asked Dick Pound about the expansion and commercialization of world sport. In October 1986, coincidentally the same week that Vancouver's Expo 86 closed, the IOC, under President Juan Antonio Samaranch, decided to let professionals compete and to change the schedule of the Games. The Winter Games would come 2 years after the Summer Games, instead of in the same year. With that, Pound negotiated TV and sponsorship deals that enabled world sport to capitalize on the eventual internet revolution to bring the Olympics to more people in more places.
My phone rang one day in the office, and I said, Deke, I was Deke. It's Juan Antonio. Yeah, hi, Juan. He says, you're the chairman of our television negotiations committee. I said, we don't have a committee like that. He said, well, we do now, and you're chairing it. And I said, I don't know anything about television. And he said, that's been our problem. None of us knows enough about it. It's our major asset. And up to now, the IOC had been so risk adverse. It just said, let's not get into this because we might end up being responsible for anything that goes wrong. So we used to let the organizing committees do the negotiations. And of course, they knew nothing about it either. They all depended on getting professional advice, and that just, it was a very disjointed arrangement. It was sort of complicated by the fact that each organizing committee only cared about its games. Didn't care what had happened before, although they liked to see how much they got before, and they'd try and improve on that. But it didn't give a hoot about what followed. So you had all these static blocks, if you like, instead of a continuum. And so once we got into it, we had to sort of wrest away the control of this from the organizing committees, who thought the television rights were theirs, you know, even though they weren't. And the sort of the percentage that we took was seen as a grab of their revenues by the IOC. So they were very upset about us getting into the field, and it took us three steps to do it. The first one, which is when I got involved, was we would have joint negotiations, IOC and the organizing committees, and that meant, of course, you had to agree when the negotiations would be, who they'd be with, what the right amount would be, and the contractual provisions. It was a complete mess. And I remember the first ones we did were for Calgary. And we were looking at the way the ABC, which had the rights for Lake Placid and was bidding for Sarajevo, and actually had Sarajevo as well, but would be bidding for Calgary. They're selling these things as Miracle on Ice 2, you know, like Rambo 2. We said, the Americans are going to get killed. I mean, they're hockey, they're bloody lucky in Lake Placid. and their hockey team is no better, and they're going to have a bad Olympics, so we should negotiate before the games, because if the Olympics are bad, then, you know, the rights will go down. Calgary said, no, our guys, Mark McCormick's outfit. They were sort of kind of being a little retentive, you know. The longer you hold on to this, the more valuable it becomes. They were saying, well, no, and they said, well, I'm sorry, we rely on our advisors. All right, well, what do they say you're going to get? Oh, they said, we're going to get $200 million or more. I said, okay, guarantee us our share of $200 million. You can have the negotiations whenever you like. Oh, that might say, well, you know, we're an organizing committee. We can't afford to take this. Hey, guys, you can't have it both ways. If you trust your advisors that much, put your money where your mouth is. If you don't, then let's have the negotiations before. So they scuffed the carpet for quite a while. Finally said, oh, you know, oh, fuck, all right. You know, off we went, and we got $309 million. So the whining stopped for that. So that was the first step. The next was for the ones after that, was like for Barcelona and Albertville. We negotiated in consultation with the organizing committees. Yeah, fairly close, because they're your partners, but we weren't going to make the final decision. And that went through sort of 92, 94, up to 96. And then after 96, we did them all by ourselves. And we simply told the organizing committees what they were going to get. But because we ended up having these relationships with the broadcasters, the rights grew and grew and grew and grew. And we helped them because we knew, we learned more about our brand and how to promote it and what the value in the marketplace was, and, you know, how you could link your broadcast advertising with your own commercial messages and the Olympic. And anyway, so it turned out to be really good. I remember the example I've always used on that is in Montreal for 1976, the worldwide television rights were $35 million. For Atlanta, they were $930 million, and now they're north of a couple of billion. And that's because we managed it. Mm-hmm. So that was we got the television right. I mean, it took a while. I remember, well, I used to pretend I was negotiating in Italian lira, because if you were talking about $200 million or $300 million, that was real money in those days. And then I had in the early 1980s, phone rang again. He said, Deke. Says, you're the chairman of our marketing commission. I said, we don't have a marketing commission. Yes, we do. You're it. So we got all of our eggs in one basket. It's the television basket. It's an economic model that turn your bowels to water. And so we need to have a marketing program. And we need to generally reduce our dependence, financial dependence, on the United States. You know, with that free market and the antitrust and so on, they had real bidding. But if you're dealing with the European Broadcast Union or Japan Pool or you know, the other broadcast unions, they were quite happy to have the Americans carry all the water, and they kept the rights really depressed. So we had those two agendas going, and then the marketing thing turned out to be the concept of putting together the marketing rights of the in those days, the Winter Organizing Committee, the Summer Organizing Committee, all of the National Olympic Committees, and the IOC, in a one-stop shopping opportunity for them. But it was fantastic, because a lot of the sponsors said, you know, we love the Olympics, but the problem is you're too hard to do business with, which is an alarm bell that should go off in your head when you hear it. And they said, you know, if we get the organizing committees, that's fine. Then we have to, every country where we want to activate these rights, we got to come and make a deal with the National Olympic Committee. And that takes forever, and you have a bell curve of commercial expertise. And you know, the U.S. is pretty developed. Canada is pretty developed. France and Britain, and all that. But 95% of them had no idea what marketing was all about. And frankly, no markets. mean, these are the days before the BRIC countries came on stream. The Belgian rights were worth more than the rights in China.
But fewer cities can now afford to host the games. Paris and LA have the next two summer games in 2024 and 2028. Only two cities were in the running for the 2022 winter games, which Beijing will host. Same for 2026, after Calgary voted last year against their bid. The IOC will pick either Stockholm, Sweden, or Milan, Italy, in June. There is also the dark underbelly of the games related to the spoils of victory. The leaders of the Rio 2016 and Tokyo 2020 organizing committees have been implicated in a multi-million dollar vote-buying scandal. Pound said the unverified $50 billion cost of Sochi 2014 needs to be put in context. He says that Russia built sport and tourism infrastructure from scratch, because many of its older facilities were built in republics that left the Soviet Union. However, Pound concedes, it has always been a challenge to manage organizing committees in far-flung places.
It's hard to get in there and manage a construction project from Lausanne. I mean, you build in these contractual undertakings and so on, but if there's going to be corruption, there's going to be corruption. But I think what we did do, I chaired, you may remember, I chaired a commission that was established in, I think, during the Salt Lake Games. So it was the Olympic Games Study Commission to say, how can we reduce the costs of this and make some of this transparency occur? And, you know, one of the ways is you say, look, we don't want you to get stuck because international federations want a 30,000 seat stadium for basketball, which will be filled twice in its entire existence. So, you know, we can help you cut that down. You know, 12,000 or 15,000 is plenty. It'll cost you a third of what the big one would cost, and then cost you a third of what maintenance would have been. So we can do that. So we don't. The IOC does not insist on the Bird's Nest Stadium. 200,000 people, fine, in Beijing, maybe, except they haven't capitalized on it either. I just say that, you know, the Olympic needs are this, and anything over and above that, you have to explain to your own people why it is you think you need these extended facilities. And the other stuff, of course, is as you know, the municipal planning and infrastructure is a dicey game at any time. And so when you've got the Olympics, you say, look, this is our chance. We got a 7 or 8 year period here, because we know that on Friday, July 16th at 8 p.m., the guy with the Greek flag steps onto the track. Not 8:05, not Saturday the 17th, you know. So you've got this huge opportunity to do a whole bunch of things. And so all of the planners, domestic planners, say, well, let's do a big infrastructure program here. And then that gets lumped into the so-called games cost for the two-week event. So we have not been very good about explaining that and what local committees should be looking out for.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau. No! Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways. If a politician secretly records a conversation with anyone, it's wrong. When that politician is a cabinet minister secretly recording a public servant, it's wrong. And when that cabinet minister is the Attorney General of Canada secretly recording the clerk of the Privy Council, it's unconscionable.
If you stand up for what you believe is right and you hold strong to your principles, The truth and principles must always come first, and that's what I did, and that's what I'll continue to do.
The Prime Minister seemed to make the firing offence. I mean, in his speech, he referred explicitly to the lack of trust, and he explicitly referred, he called it unconscionable to record the clerk of the Privy Council, and that seemed to be among many of your colleagues as well, what they considered the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, I think that, first of all, trust is a two-way street. And talking about unconscionable, I think it is, and I can talk about the tape in a minute, it's unconscionable to tread over the independence of the prosecutor. It is unconscionable not to uphold the rule of law. And I have always maintained that stance. I think it is very alarming that people are focusing on the actual recording of a tape as opposed to the contents of the tape. The contents of the tape, in my view, and in the view of many people that have reached out, speak for itself. I said and explained in my submission why I did that. What I'll say, I recorded that tape. There's nothing illegal about it, and I said in any other circumstance it would be inappropriate. I was protecting myself. I knew that something very dangerous and wrong was going to happen, and that my job was at risk.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of British Columbia's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all the people who did their part to help Humboldt, Saskatchewan stay strong amid the tragedy of April 6, 2018. On the anniversary, Canada looked back at the lives of the 16 who died and the 13 who were injured in the horrible truck and bus crash in rural Saskatchewan. May there be a legacy of more organ donors and more safety on our highways. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 7th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 7th in 1868, the Irish-born writer, politician, and father of Confederation, Thomas D'Arcy McGee, was assassinated in Ottawa? Patrick Whelan was convicted and hanged for murder in February 1869. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.